You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR 8:55 a.m. streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. It's raining outside, Tobia.
Yeah, I know. I brought my jacket and my beanie.
I know, it's unbelievable. You can't work out if you're overdressed, underdressed or whatever. You just have to bring everything.
Got to remember the onion, you know, the dress and layers.
Right. You're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie and Tobia, and we've got also some ring-ins. We've got Amy. G'day, Amy.
Hey.
And Amy. Matthew, how are you?
Good, thanks. Very good to be in the studio on this very wet and somewhat dreary morning.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. It always feels nice, doesn't it, too? Nice and cosy.
Mm,
yeah, yeah, it's good. You were telling us off air that the Iranians have come, hit the jackpot. They're a smart crew.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's that thing, you know, when one side's all real estate investors and stockbrokers and the other side's all engineers.
Ah,
kind of a bit of a power balance in terms of negotiations.
Yeah, interesting.
But yeah, we were following because we were talking about
Amy
Goodman.
Of course,
Goodman.
We're in West Asia and we're talking about the supposed
Iran deal.
Yep.
Yeah, which has left her much stronger than I think anyone's willing to admit. Yeah, we're just saying that Jeremy Scahill, the Dropsite News reporter, was saying that he was talking to the Iranian mediators and they had employed an entire team of psychologists to analyze Donald Trump's senility and then plan their negotiation strategy around that, which ended up obviously resulting in pretty good turnout for them.
But they were happy.
They were happy with the outcome, and it places them in a much better place. But, I mean, it's left even Sky News reeling. They were unable to put it in their field of view what that sort of meant, apart from a strategic defeat. And we've seen,
it's like Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah,
they've gone from waltzing to foxtrot.
Yeah,
I hope they're doing that Blackadder bit where Baldrick's like, "I've got a cunning plan," and then Donald Trump's like, "Shut up, I've got a cunning plan."
There is, of course, it's not a very funny situation, really, but it's good to have a laugh. APAN reports that in Palestine, Israel continues its relentless violation of the so-called ceasefire agreement, killing over 1,000 Palestinians since it took effect. On Sunday, three-year-old Raya Abu al-Ajin was murdered by Israeli forces by gunshot in the head as he was walking with his father in Gaza. In the West Bank, settler violence and settlement expansion continues to escalate. This week saw an intensification in Israel's pattern of targeting Palestinian religious sites. Settlers vandalized and burnt a mosque in the occupied village of Jal Julia. Arson attacks burnt out Al-Mara Mosque in Dibwa and Al-Nur Mosque in the neighbouring town of Burqa.
We've seen also ABC kind of be forced to do its reporting and report on the killing of a seven-month-old baby in a car by a sniper attack a week ago. And so even the ABC is being forced to report the truth.
Well, that leads to the fact that the Australian government has this week committed to undertaking an independent investigation in Israel's assaults, sexual assaults and torture of the flotilla activist after a meeting with the victims.
Even though they're going at great lengths to say, just keep saying alleged. And forced under great pressure, the AFP is to investigate.
And also the Israeli ambassador was reported as saying in, I think, The Age, I read him saying, well, you know, it's all rubbish. There's no proof.
He said they were treated with the utmost sensibility.
Yeah, exactly. And we haven't been given any advice by the AFP We respect the AFP. Really what they're saying is you haven't got any legs and how are you going to prove it anyway? It's like when my kid was at school and there was a fight and apparently she stood there and put her finger, I mean, we're talking primary school and we're talking, you know, grade three or four, and she put, they're standing in the yard and apparently she put her finger on her chin and went, you know, come at me, go on, come on, come at me. But that's the politics of the Israeli ambassador.
I think not to compare your kid to the Israeli ambassador.
It's just that approach. I just thought she was a great maverick, but I was just sort of thinking it's the same in.
Well,
this,
it is a maverick approach, is what
it's
they're
a maverick
doing,
approach,
and I think
it?
It's not working out for them too well. We've seen even ultra-conservative J.D. Vance kind of remind the Israeli cabinet, specifically at a conference, who their friends were, and that the what do they call it in America? POTUS, the President of the United States, was the only friend they had left in the free world that gave them any credit. So,
well, in Australia, the Julian Siegel crew have been working their little butts off, and on the 18th of June, the Australian Health Practitioners Regulation Agency, AHPRA, put out a joint statement with the so-called Special Envoy to Combat Anti-Semitism, in which it declared that it had adopted the highly controversial IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which of course conflates anti-Semitism with attacks on the Israeli state. There are real concerns that the end result of this will be a significant increase in the number of doctors and nurses having their registration suspended or cancelled for speaking out against Israel. When Zionist complaints previously were made to AHPRA about practitioners wearing a pro-Palestinian badge or a kafir, they were not considered to be an issue for professional rebuke. This change is dangerous in an overtaxed public health system, and this is without the infringement of, and is also an infringement on citizens' right to freedom of speech in a democracy. And it's says a prominent human rights lawyer, Nick Hanna from Civil Liberties Defence Centre.
That what you just said, Annie, that reminds me of something, a news item that came across this week, and I didn't get a lot of coverage here. Actually, the quite prestigious medical journal, The Lancet actually called for the Israeli Medical Association, and called them out for not taking a stance against the ongoing genocide throughout all of Palestine. Obviously, that's extended to Lebanon as well. So that's just an interesting contrast there.
Yeah, exactly.
And The Lancet's a pretty neutral sort of medical journal. They don't really take many positions, so it's quite significant. The last report that they released was that they
actually follow the facts.
Yeah.
They don't find it necessary to colour things. Killing children is called a war crime.
Yeah.
And you don't actually have to get into the semantics of, is it okay? Is it a you don't go from murdering children to we're allowed to be a state.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's apples and oranges, mate.
Yeah, and just civilians in general in Palestine.
I mean, it's ridiculous.
And just civilians in Palestine in general, like it's just ridiculous. I mean,
we don't have to agree with it.
Yeah, well, that's disgusting.
Yeah.
And just like you were saying earlier, they're alleged in all this while Ben-Gavir is posting all these videos.
And the thing to say that it's not being, it's a Ben-Gavir problem. I think the day after Ben-Gavir released his video, the Department of Transport, the Minister for the Department of Transport posted a video saying that, you know, welcome to Israel, this is how we do things here, and posting in front of all the prison boats and stuff like that.
So, well, there's also...
mate, your job's buses.
Yeah, exactly. They're all trying to get onto the act. It's interesting too that there's reports, very cogent reports coming out of England where young activists have been, young and old activists have been outside a real estate conference where they were selling off Zionists. real estate conference selling off properties in illegally occupied sections of Palestine. Peak organisation of jury in England came out saying that the activists were misinformed and they were behaving in an outrageously anti-Semitic fashion. It was provable that in actual fact they were selling properties in illegal sections of the illegally occupied Palestine, and that the people out the front were acting in a highly peaceful manner, while the people who were supportive of these Zionists' approach actually physically attacked them. And as the person who was reporting on this said, and the police did nothing.
Mm.
And so they were querying the behaviour of the English state to support a genocidal organisation versus people who were standing against genocide. Now, this is actually a democratic dissonance.
Yeah, and also these kinds of protests have stopped these kinds of land sales before. And so the approach is proved to work.
Yeah. Exactly. We're going to move to something else. Vivian, who reports for us and has given us a report for Voices for Palestine, she's from Climate Action Show on Monday at 5 p.m. and she wants people to realise that they've got a small speech by the inspirational president of Colombia, Gustavo Petro, and if you want to know more of the issues that have been coming out of the Santa Maria conference in Colombia, the first international conference on how to phase out fossil fuels, you should go back to their back issue of podcasts. This is the Climate Action Show. Vivian states it will be a massive setback to climate leadership if his party loses in the upcoming elections. Petro prohibited all new coal, oil and gas projects and cancelled all coal shipments to Israel. If you've been following this issue, you'll know that there were various countries sent fairly high-powered people to this particular conference because they're really pulling their sleeves up to come up with ways and means of extricating their communities outside the use of fossil fuels. Interestingly enough, Australia sent a low-grade public servant to the same event.
And I mean, well, the last news item that you have here, we can talk about the high-grade public servants that have gone out to represent their own interests and the AU rank-and-file members that refused the offer put to them by the union from the government, which was below the needs of the workers and offered better outcomes for some sectors of the workforce, leaving particularly education support workers behind. The 28% pay offer over 4 years was below the 35% being fought for and does not address issues of conditions including workloads and class composition. The vote from the 60,000 strong members, 57.7% against 42.2% and then 42.3% for.
Yeah.
And so we saw some pretty...
It was a win.
It was a win and it was a pretty incredible win. Even the Age was...
They're shaking in their boots.
Yeah.
And Ben Carroll, the Minister for Education, says that the union leadership can't control its members. It's like the father can't control their unruly children.
Meanwhile, it's all smiles and happy faces in the crowd, even in the Age.
Yeah, yeah. There is happy,
pretty cheery photos. So just to show what rank and file union membership can do and these campaigns can do and can achieve. You're on Solidarity Breakfast.
Guinea, this is Birrigan from Bulagan, coming live from the occupied territories of Gumbengi Country, Nambucca Heads, New South Wales. You're listening to 3CR Radical Radio.
These are the voices of absolute bravery. Two women who went on the flotilla to Gaza and were imprisoned on an Israeli warship speak out at Hyde Park in Sydney. Since these speeches, they have met with the Honourable Penny Wong, and to hear a chilling account of that, please listen to Michael West's interview with documentary filmmaker Juliette Lamont. Today, Juliette speaks alongside Jewish anti-Zionist speaker Annie Mercator. Just for the record, France and Spain have fiercely condemned the treatment of their citizens by Israeli soldiers, and together with Ireland and Italy, they've pushed the EU and the UN to consider sanctions on Israeli officials. France has opened a war crimes probe. So Australia has quite a way to go in standing up for these very brave people.
Like, it's one thing being a sailor and then trying to deliver baby food and critical medicine and prosthetic limbs for children and titanium plates that they need to mend together multiple fractures in their bones. But it's another thing being someone public speaking. I find this terrifying. So hang in. I just got a text message from my mother and she said, Juliette, please don't swear. But I'm going to say F*** Albanese and his moral ineptitude and his pretend when he was a student supporter of Palestine. Yay. I'm going to say F*** the Foreign Minister Penny Wong and her faux concern for what happened to our bodies. I'm going to say F*** genocide. Yay. I'm going to say F*** Zionism, and I'm going to say dealing with the two-way arms trade and our integral parts that we do supply Israel. Without some of the parts that we make in this country on this stolen land, there would be no 2,000-pound bombs coming out of the guts of the F-35 fighter jets. So f*** them too. And now I'll stop swearing and maybe my daughter can edit that bit out and give it to my mum. What was really amazing about this flotilla compared to the last one, we got really close, we got 24 nautical miles away from Gaza, we could see it. Every atom of our being thought that we would get there. This time we were in international waters, we were 270 nautical miles away, we were south of Cyprus, and the hubris and the arrogance of the Israeli occupation forces to intercept us in broad daylight. I mean, they still wear balaclavas because they know when the war crimes go through The Hague, they will be punished. I suppose the disappointment of not getting as close as the last time was then fulfilled with the realization that because 428 ordinary people from all across the world, journalists, nurses, teachers, my daughter was one of them. Because I don't use the word torture lightly, and I don't think that happened last time, but it happened this time. We were systematically tortured, sexually assaulted, waterboarded. I was raped by an Israeli soldier. I was kicked so hard in the small of my back that they've broken my coccyx. And that was just the beginning of a relentless, calculated system of punishment and psychological and physical torture that went on for about 5.5 days. This is not to diminish what happens to Palestinians every single day. We got the 5-star treatment. We are able to come back to this country, this stolen land, and the ongoing genocide of the First Nations people, and we're able to talk about our treatment, and suddenly it's a news story. And that is a shame. Because why has it taken over 8 decades for us to even care about Palestinian bodies? And we need to do everything that we can as a collective power. We need to escalate. We know the weapons companies that are in Australia. We need to get on their roofs. We need, it's probably going to get me into trouble, but we need to smash the shit out of these death cults. And we need to get rid of the Israeli ambassador. We need to force a meeting with Albanese and Penny Wong. We need to not let the people who perpetuate the violence investigate their own crimes, and we need to stop arming Israel. We need to stop even giving them air conditioners or any food. Whatever it is we give to the Israeli regime, we need to stop it now.
Absolutely.
And we have so much power together. The hubris and the arrogance of Ben Gvir's video, that was like that was the tip of the iceberg compared to what actually happened. Ben Gvir is not a bad egg. He is not, you know, like this evil, you know, terror. He is symptomatic and illustrative of every single Israeli person in the government and the people who support them. So we need to dismantle. I know people think that's radical, but we do need to dismantle Zionism. And what they don't know is that love and solidarity is something that cannot be bombed, that cannot be raped, that cannot, you know, love cannot be broken. And we have so much love together. And we will continue to fight until Palestine is free. Globalize the Intifada!
Thank you so much. I want to finally, for our flotilla speakers, introduce Annie from Jews Against the Occupation 48 and the Loud Jew Collective. Make her welcome.
Hi, thanks for letting me speak here. The flotilla, it's the first time I've had an opportunity to speak, so I'm not so au fait with it. I've written it all down. I'll talk about the spirit of the flotilla, the bravery of the Palestinian people, and the barbaric and psycho-monstrosity known as the IOF. I do so as an anti-Zionist Jewish participant who sailed with the GSF on an international mission to break the illegal blockade of the port of Gaza. I sailed to defy DFATs and the Australian government's position, which enables Israel's piracy in the Mediterranean. With this as its political goal, the humanitarian goal of the GSF is to deliver aid, messages of support and hope to those in the occupied Gaza and occupied Palestine. So participating in this journey became one of the important experiences of my life. It's been close to 2 weeks since I've been back, and yet I feel as if I'm still on the boat with my comrades and we still hope to reach Gaza. I feel shame that we didn't make it to help the Palestinian people, and shame at our government's response to our attempt. And yet I take kind of heart that the word Sumud in the global Sumud flotilla emulates the Arabic word Sumud, meaning steadfastness and perseverance. It's a symbol of the resistance and dedication to hope that the Palestinian people in Gaza have. We'd hoped that we could break the siege, even though we knew the odds of this happening were very much against us. In fact, hope was one of the most important aspects of our mission, and it almost became a valued friend on the boats. The hope that the engines wouldn't fail, the sails wouldn't collapse, the Starlink network would persevere, the batteries would last, the whole crew wouldn't get seasick at the same time, and that we'd get used to washing bodies and plates in the sea. And that no matter what, we wouldn't be afraid and we'd take what came as a consequence of our act of defiance. I don't want to talk too much about our kidnapping and illegal imprisonment by Israel, as I'm sure many of you have followed the barbaric actions of Zionist Israel's IOF towards the flotilla participants, and my colleagues have spoken to that. I want to speak about the Israeli Zionist project as it appears to me, an anti-Zionist Jew and a child of Holocaust survivors. I want to speak about my experience amongst Zionist jailers. I've long been aware of Israel's project to draw the world into its xenophobic, Machiavellian and megalomaniac perspectives. And as an Australian, I've seen how our government, regardless of party politics, has become hostage to the Zionist agenda. How politicians have been literally bought and wedded to the Zionist ideology, and how aspects of our civil society and cultural heritage are being prescribed by Zionist thuggery. The Australian government, once again, has capitulated to Zionist Israel. Albanese has become a pawn in a game which affects so many aspects of our democracy, whatever that word now implies. From the decisions about what is portrayed in our media to what happens in our streets and at our demonstrations like these, to who has a voice in our royal commissions and to who holds power in our councils. I want to talk about what is at the heart of Zionist racist project. And actually, I suspect that we all know, but that we easily forget, that the project of Zionism is to turn the people of Australia and the world against the Palestinians, and further, to incite Islamophobia and hatred of Arabs. I mean, this is an exercise of pure opportunism. This is, of course, not so hard in Australia, a colony still in the grip of racism. Our First Nations people know about genocide, they know about ongoing racism and governmental ineffectiveness as an inherent aspect of colonialisation. The persistent structural racism towards Indigenous Australians indeed testifies to Australia's easy support of genocidal colonial projects. What's happening in Palestine with genocide, with apartheid, is a desecration of the sacred consideration of the Jewish ethos that I grew up with and still believe in. Never again is never again for everyone. Because through the desecration of the notion of everyone to not all everyone's, the concept of victimhood that the Jewish people have genuinely held is now being used as a manipulative tool and has become emblematic of a people who have lost their humanity. This is what I saw when we were abducted, as we were being terrorised and threatened by what seemed to be robots with faulty wiring, but were in fact children of Zionism, young Zionists who called themselves Jews. Played out before me in the eyes, faces and demeanour of the Israeli soldiers whose guns were constantly trained on us, who threatened us with death, who beat my comrades, who violated my friends and who wanted to kill us. I saw the depraved children of the Zionist regime, a cult whose humanity has been lost between the ideologies of victimhood and oppressor. A reverse dramaturgy in which retribution to the world has turned into a recreation of the Holocaust, in which the victims become the perpetrators, and in which Israelis can live out their fantasy of retribution. When 180 of us were pushed into the space of 10 metres by IOP soldiers with their weaponry and their masks, our hands held high above our head, when the tension in their bodies was palpable and the urgency of their movements was terrifying, all I could think of was the images I'd seen as a child of naked men and women standing hands held high in front of what would become their graves within seconds of the photograph being taken. Or the child small like me when I first saw her at about the age of 6, hands high walking in front of a group towards the cattle truck that would take her and her family to the camps and death. What is this madness that lets the world relive these images again of dead children, murdered families, destroyed hospitals? And we know the list by heart. It goes on and on. These images are carried out in real time, carried out with impunity by the youths who have been brainwashed into a killing cult. The Palestinians will rise, and I believe that. And I have the belief in their sumud, in their humanity. I have belief that Hamas, and I'll say the word, Hamas, will do what it does because I understand that it plays out the same trauma. A few weeks ago, when we were still on the boat, we were in a Zoom with a young Palestinian working as an NGO with women and children in Gaza. He spoke to us with his heart and he said, "We know you may not succeed, but for us what matters is that you are coming, that you want to come, and that you see us and you care. This gives us hope and this brings us comfort, that you show the world we are here. Don't feel bad if you don't make it." But I do feel bad, and I feel like I have to keep ramming the vessels we sail into the consciousness of the Zionists and the world. I know that our aid lies at the bottom of the sea, our medicines, insignificant as they were, to the larger picture might wash up somewhere in Turkey. But it shouldn't just be up to us to bring aid, but to international governments. It was Penny Wong who told the UN that Australia would stand behind and deliver aid by community groups if it had to. Oh, wow. Except us, of course. I know that Sumud is what they continue to have in Palestine, and that Sumud is what we need as activists and what we use to continue the fight to free Palestine. I know we'll sail again, and I'll sail because I know that we are expected there. So I hope we do more than chant. I hope we act. From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free.
Solidarity Breakfast with Tobiah, and we've got Amy and Matt, and we've got also the historian Rowan Cahill on the line. G'day, Rowan. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you very much, comrades.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you. You've just put out a book called Author, Cold War kid resisting Vietnam War. And as you say in the beginning of the book, you were sort of encouraged to write a history because people would often ask you about the big battle when it came to conscription during the Vietnam War. What did you find out when you started writing this book, when you collected together the recollections?
It was as you say, I wrote it because, because of what I did in the 60s and 70s have made me a subject of historical interest in much later years. I'm 81 now, and what I did back in my 20s is now of historical interest, and I am entering articles and history books as a historical actor. Sometimes, people sort of get it wrong and I don't really recognise myself, so I just thought, well, I will put down my version of what happened and just leave it there.
Well, you are a historian, and one of the things that's so interesting about this book, in my view, is the way you have a way of writing recollections and then you anchor them to key historical points, which gives great clarity.
Yeah, well, I was conscripted in the first of the call-ups, and then I took oppositional views then, and that made me sort of made me an enemy of the state, and I ended up with criminalised. But if I hadn't been conscripted, you wouldn't be talking with me today, and B, I would have been another sort of person. All I wanted to be at that time was a poet. And basically a glorified maritime beachcomber up on the Whitsunday Passage. Now, history intervened, tapped me on the shoulder, and I had a choice. Go along with what the Menzies government wanted me to do or take a rebel stand. And I took a rebel stand. And the point is that history is there, touching us all the time. It's touching us now with the Gaza. It's touching us now with the bloody legislations and the criminalisation of the Gaza demonstrations and stuff like that. History is always there, touching us. It's what we do when we recognise that we are part of history. We're all makers of history, even when we're just ordinary Joe Blow citizens. And we make history either by doing stuff or by saying, OK, I'll let it go on. Either way, through activism or acquiescence, we are makers of history. So, history and big events are in my life because they're touching all of us all of the time, every day.
Now, one of the things that's important too is in this book is the background. I find it fascinating. You give us a little look into what Sydney looked like before it became tall buildings. You lived about 11 miles at that time away from the city centre, but you were in the northern suburbs, but you were near the bush. You were on the edge of the bush, and you learnt about the bush from your father. But your father had this other influence too, and a doorway into Colonel De Groot's new front.
Yeah, well, Dad was a teenage New Guard.
New Guard, that was it.
Yeah, New Guard activist in those in his adolescence, and subsequently there were a number of ex-policemen and ex-spooks used to sort of be within his orbit. So I don't know much about the full details of Dad's life, but yes, he was conservative, but also. He was a wonderful bushman and a wonderful teacher about self-confidence in the bush, taking care of ourselves, dealing with bushfires, teaching us about almost environmentally about the bush. So, yeah, there were good and bad aspects of his character, but yes.
But that's the point, isn't it? That's the point. It's the building of a person that then leads you to make decisions that are contrary from the conservative background that was Australia.
Yeah. And I call the book Cold War Kid for the simple reason. When we were conscripted in from 1965 onwards, none of us had the right to vote. You were conscripted on the cusp of turning from 19 to 20. Right. And in those days, you didn't get the right to vote until you were 21. So the Menzies government conscripted voteless youths, didn't consult them in any way, surprised the Australian electorate by introducing conscription overnight in November 1964. And it was the expectation that we would all just fall in line and say, yes, sir, no, sir, do what the government wanted. And that's why I spent time in the first half of the book describing being groomed to be conservative. I look upon it like the Menzies government were like bloody pedophilic groomers. And they were grooming us to be acquiescent, subservient, yes, sir, no, sir, go into the army, yes, sir. Fight the communists, yes, sir. Go and do some imperialist adventuring overseas, yes, sir, no problem. Well, it might have worked in the past, but it didn't work then.
Fascinating stuff.
I mean, Amy, you were talking about this, just the Adorno checklist.
Oh, yeah, the F-scale, Adorno's personality test for fascism. It's probably needs a bit of an update, but, yeah, the idea that, you know, do you have... do you believe that obedience is the most important thing that you need in a child? These sort of traits, very sort of lack of empathetic traits. I was actually just thinking when you're talking about growing up bush, you're sort of the opposite to Les Hiddens, the bush tucker man, the major Les Hiddens, because he's sort of very, he's always been very proud of his military career and his contributions to the Australian Offence Force.
So, Rowan, you went off to Sydney University, and this is also an important milestone because this, you're the first person in your family to go to university.
Yeah, well, from a very early age, and I was about six when I told my mother I wanted to write books, but I chose the wrong words. I said, Mummy, I said, when I grow up, I want to be a bookmaker. And she thought, yeah, she was very against Dad's drinking and his alcohol and some of his mates and that stuff like that. She came from a conservative church background. And when I said I want to be a bookmaker, because I wanted to make books, I write them. She thought I had picked up a bad word from Dad about gambling, you see.
And, I'd be a bookmaker.
It didn't get any better thereafter. That's all I ever wanted to do. I wanted to write. And then I remember going to a careers advisor at school, it's compulsory, and saying, oh, yes, I want to write. And he thought the only writers he knew about were journalists. He pulled out my school report cards. And I remember this bastard. He sat there across the table and he said, and you called Mr. Carl in those days. And he went, he said, oh, Mr. Carl, he said, there's nothing here that suggests you've got that ability whatsoever. Seems to me you should go in and be a clerk in the public service. And,
well, it's all history now.
Yeah. And see, in my reading thereafter, writers seem to go to university and do arts degrees. And I thought, oh, shit, that's how you do it. And so I ended up at university. I had the chance to, so I went, yeah.
Yeah, it's very exciting. It would have been exciting at the time. So basically what you're saying is you're muddling along, finding going into a whole other world, which, of course, going to a university is. And then, of course, the conscription falls upon you on your lap, and so your trajectory changes and you become an activist, effectively.
Well, basically, yes, and that was a good word, muddling along. And then even when we were in activism, it was muddling along too, because the anti-war movement in 1964-65 was very small. When they put it into the history books, you tend to show the dirty great big Melbourne Moratorium marches, and they're glorious. And you do the Sydney Moratorium march, and that's glorious. And you hop up to Queensland and you show the anti-Joe Belky Peterson demonstrations, and they're great. And then you, you shove in some shots of the anti-apartheid movement, photographs of the next few years later, and they're terrific. And people get the idea, oh, yeah, in the 1960s, people were out there in the masses doing all this marvellous stuff. Well, in the beginning, you might as well. Yeah, I describe a scene where, in the book, where in the early days at Sydney University, there's three of us with a megaphone sprouting anti-conscription and anti-Vietnam things, and there's a dirty great big crowd of people coming towards us to go to lunch, and they give us a great big detour like we're a leper colony or something.
Hmm. Yeah.
It's an important aspect of remembering history because, I mean, one, it's, yeah, remembering the radical history of Australia, not just, you know, casting everything into the dustbin of history, saying it was all conservative rubbish, but also that these great big movements had small little beginnings, and that's the important thing to remember, even for people that are movement building today.
And a hell of a lot of activism went into building that movement. And the other thing that's important to note too, there's another book out at the same time as mine by another colleague from Newcastle. I'm from Wollongong, she's from Newcastle. But she's written a book about the New South Wales protest, and she's done a micro-study of New South Wales, the anti-war movement. And she's avoided the big names and the famous names because historians tend to focus on the leaders. And you write, and they write top-down accounts of protest, even sort of friendly historians. And the point is, an effective movement is masses of people who are never known to history. You know, the people who make the phone calls, who do the building, run off the leaflets, write the leaflets, raise money, do the banners. And these people don't leave paper trails. They don't leave signatures. And the mass media doesn't sort of really write about them or fix on them because they're not dramatic, they're not theatrical.
Yeah, but they believe in positive change.
And they're the people who bloody... They're the machinery, the cogs of the movement.
I think that's absolutely true. I remember in primary school when we learnt about high school when we learnt about the Vietnam War, we spent a long time on John Lennon and Yoko Ono. It's just like, really?
Yeah. It's like, I forget how many thousands were out there. There were 20 to 40,000 up in Sydney in the first of the moratorium marches, demonstrations outside Sydney Town Hall. The crowds were bigger in Melbourne down here. It's like, so there's thousands upon thousands of people out in the street and you write about two or three for people.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's part of your legacy, isn't it? The cohort of historians that built... radical history. I mean, it's an important thing that working class history, ordinary people history, that is the current of change, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And it's like, the poet Bertolt Brecht wrote about, famous people who built the pyramids, who did this, who did that in ancient history. Was it the great leaders? Who built the pyramids?
Yeah, who actually did it?
Yeah.
I mean, there's actually, I was looking at it's a pretty well... a beautiful bronze of Matthew Flinders outside one of the churches here. And they've actually, he's standing erect on a small boat and there's two men underneath it, which we don't see the face of, holding it up on their back. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, that's the most repulsive statue, even though it's beautifully made.
Yeah, and you know, it's the ordinary people who actually build, create and do stuff. And once you realise as an ordinary person that you are a maker of history, either by compliance or otherwise, man, it's a liberating thought.
It sure is. There's a book launch today for Cold War Kid Resisting the Vietnam War. It's going to be at Ballum Ballum in Brunswick at 3, going to 5, and you're going to be there.
I'm going to swim down, yeah.
Thanks for talking to us this morning, Rowan.
It's a very, very pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We're celebrating 50 years of 3CR on Saturday, the 4th of July at Collingwood Town Hall. There'll be stalls, displays, great food, performances, activities, prizes, and so much more. It's a birthday for us, and we can't wait to celebrate with you. Saturday, the 4th of July, Collingwood Town Hall, 11 a.m. till 4 p.m. Bring your family, tell your friends, all are welcome. 3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Let us know you're coming. Go to Humanitix and search for 3CR to RSVP.
A weak solidarity, Brekkie Team listener, when I'm scratching my head and, yes, I've washed what's left of my hair and pretty sure we're all scratching our heads as the mainstream media informs us that appalling Hoonsun's performance at the mainstream press club was a monumental success, leading us to ponder which bit of white lumpen supremacy, denouncing Islam, denouncing non-whites generally, denouncing people speaking their first language other than English, removing all support for terra nullius non-land non-people, attacking transgender true blue Aussies, questioning abortion laws and getting rid of parental leave, just to highlight her feminist solidarity, abolish unfair dismissal laws which shackle poor, caring employers with lazy, lazy workers, lazy, lazy, avaricious workers, abolishing SBS and its related non-land, non-people NITV outlet, privatising and commercialising, eviscerating the ABC. Which bit of all that and related policies is success? And which bit of pointing out hypocrisy over opposing wage increases for workers while copping a 100 grand windfall is apparently a criminal offence, an unwarranted attack on that appalling? Thank goodness we've got the mainstream media to explain all that to us, exposing the dangerous, leftist, anti-true blue Aussie values bias listeners to this station are forced to suffer. Thankfully not for long after that appalling gets her way, because there's no doubt she would be forced to rescind this station's licence. A misplaced licence to attack those cherished true blue Aussie values outlined at the mainstream press club. And what national excitement! Why? She could build a cage in the lodge gardens and we could watch all these brain-dead muscles, UFC, interesting what that could stand for, muscles belt the proverbial out of each other. After all, cockfighting and dogfighting, for instance, are banned, although maybe that appalling could bring them back as well. That would stick it up the goody-goodies who banned such fun, fun, fun. Meanwhile, in the White House cage, her hero, US of the UN of the US of the world, Big Supremo Donald Travel the Paw, Killer Travel the Paw, was set for bloody battle with the mysterious Phantom Ayatollah, kicked off by Killer announcing he had won and the fight would be over in a matter of seconds. And given no one had the courage to upset him by reminding him the fight hadn't actually started, he ran around the cage, arms raised in victory, only to be tripped by the Phantom Ayatollah, crashing face first, which Killer said proved he had won. And just when it looked like the fight might not proceed, a sensation in the Phantom Ayatollah's corner as Killer trampled the Paw's handler, not another Yahoo, leapt on the Phantom's handlers and slaughtered them all, explaining he didn't feel safe, indeed felt terrorised, as long as they weren't slaughtered. Benjamin said anyone who opposed his surprise attack and slaughter was clearly anti-Semitic and supported terrorists. This was the most moral slaughter in the world. While back at the lodge, a huge orange bulldozer roared threateningly toward Big Supremo Anthony Albanese, our very own filthiest rich of the filthy rich, Gina, waving madly and brandishing a chainsaw, just in case the bulldozer didn't do the trick. The bulldozer towing a Gina plane piloted a little awkwardly by that appalling herself. The chainsaw borrowed from Gina's hero, Elon, must have more. The least he could do after Gina invested 1.4 billion real figure in Elon's crusade to head into space and stuff up another planet just like they've stuffed up Mother Earth. I favour investing in industries led by sensible, hard-working, patriotic and exceptional people. Elon excels in every regard, she eulogised. Her Perth office inspired by Elon quotes on the need to get rid of government and hand the world over to the private sector, especially the Gina and Elon bits of the private sector. Although, beyond the hagiography, there may just be a little bit of self-interest, hard as it is to believe, of Gina. We also see the possibility of mutual beneficial arrangements, she noted, between our critical minerals investments as demand grows for the materials and infrastructure needed to support advanced technology, a technology making Elon the world's first trillionaire and Gina filthier richer and filthier richer. But just one small problem. The whole fragile enterprise is based on technology, the Financial Times. How cruel to spoil the party. Financial Times reported, doesn't actually work. Surely a minor problem, but one problem the trillionaire sorted out very quickly, a deal with his investment bankers in which he pays a fee of, this is true, nothing, zilch. That's why he's a trillionaire. Gina must admire him even more for that. And we must admire Gina for her understanding, accepting that someone has to pay for all that corporate generosity, corporate largesse. Someone, well, 500 or so someones, as Gina has sacked or, sorry, sadly had to let go, 500 workers in the Pilbara, reducing our mining activity while maintaining our production rate, she explained. And brickbats to Corb Lund, a big-time country music star in Canada, part of a huge campaign to prevent poor Gina developing a little coal mine in the Rockies just because of a bit of concern about water quality and wildlife. Corb saying he'd never spoken out in 30 years in the public eye, but this is so egregious, the risks are so high, and the rewards are so low, the only people benefiting from it are the foreign coal companies. Foreign. That's our Gina. Imagine how she must feel as her altruism comes under attack. But meanwhile, as her bulldozer charges across the lodge lawn, past the appalling UFC cage, her target displayed his usual courage under fire and buckled at the knees yet again. I think there's a mixed metaphor in there somewhere. Who would have thought? So you've listened to the complaints and decided not to disassemble the NDIS. No, but we have listened to the caring business class complaints about forcing them to waste money on their tax lawyers. And as big economic guru Jim Chalmers and I point out, the budget is the basis for consultation with the disability community. No, why do you keep talking about something that is not negotiable? After all, the budget is final. Now, some things are certain, like Anthony and the team going to water when the caring business class charges at them behind Gina's bulldozer, and the insurance industry, which held a conference this week, an insurance summit it called it, and the big announcement, premiums will have to rise far in excess of inflation for years to come. Now, why did they need an expensive conference in a posh hotel to come up with the obvious? And grilled the workers. Years of allegations of ripping workers off and audits finding serious food safety concerns, but obviously all wrong. Because Supremo Simon Crewe work harder told us the 4,000 lazy Aboriginal workers are his top priority. Forget about profit, it's the worker stupid. Number one priority, respected, other we assume, than for conditions, proper work breaks and the little matter of paying them. And now, how grossly unfair, the Competition and Consumer Commission is suing poor grilled the workers over a promotion it ran that $1 for every burger sold on Tuesdays would be donated to an environmental cause. Turned out there were all sorts of terms and conditions. Whenever we see an offer too good to refuse and terms and conditions apply, we can bet they do. Anyway, of the thousands raised, only a pittance was donated thanks to the terms and conditions. And poor Grilba is being accused of greenwashing. It's just one thing after another, isn't it, for poor Simon? And back in Gina country, we can be so proud of the big troop that was he, BHP, bloody huge profits, bloody huge polluter, faced with the threat of industrial action by its ingrate wage slaves, or sorry, a workforce, attempting quite sensibly to recruit a rebel workforce to ensure life goes on. Rebel it's described as, and we must agree, because thanks to our sensible industrial relations laws, we know mouthing the word scab is now a criminal offence. And if the industrial action proceeds and the rebel workforce moves in, let's hope the lazy avaricious strikers don't attempt to picket the worksite, because that too is a criminal offence. Finally, back where we started, killer trample the poor and the phantom Ayatollah in the UFC cage. The Optimism of the Week award must go to the Lord Rupert of Wapping Sin Tuesday headline, World Celebrates End of Iran War. With Benjamin in Donald's Corner, wait and see, we say. Good morning.
I got me a badge, got me a gun. Someday I'm gonna get to shoot someone. Be in the paper, on TV. Everybody gonna wanna interview me. Police state, pepper spray, beat and tase, escalate. Police state, it's okay. It's us that gets to investigate. Us that gets to investigate. Write some tickets, confiscate, seize and misappropriate. Buy some gear and fancy guns to use upon the citizens. I love civil forfeiture, it's making lots of money for cameras that won't film us when someone has an accident. Police state, pepper spray, beat and tase, escalate. Police state, it's okay, it's us that gets to investigate. Us that gets to investigate. 90 days with full pay, time off just to contemplate the fact that I can have my fun. No other cops will tell no one. Cruise my cruiser down the street, why would I ever walk a beat? I locally familiarize, much more fun to militarize. Police state, pepper spray, beat and tase, escalate. Police state, it's okay, it's us that gets to investigate. Us that gets to investigate.
Well, you're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie and Tobias and Amy and Matt today, this morning. Luckily enough, they came in from the rain. And that was the person that was mentioned in Kevin's piece. That's the Canadian country singer. So
he's Cor Blund.
Cor Blund. So he's worth following up, I thought. I thought that's so cute because it's, you know, things don't change. The same here.
Yeah, same. Absolutely. And we hear from Rowan as well that it was much the same during the Vietnam War protests.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to go to, and probably for the S11 protests in 2000, and most definitely. And we're doing a retrospective with the other breakfast shows over June to highlight our 50 years of activism at 3CR. This is a piece from The Vault. It's a part of the 12 audio pieces that we're going to play. We're looking back 26 years to a pivotal protest against the World Economic Forum held in Melbourne in the year 2000, which brought desperate organising groups together into a broad coalition against globalisation, multinational domination, widespread neoliberal policy, and many other issues. Boy, were they right. They were on the money.
I estimate 50 to 60,000 people, if the Herald Sun's listening, 50 to 60,000 peaceful demonstrators here outside Crown Casino.
I walk around and see people acting very peacefully and seeing a different portrayal in the media. And I also talk to people who know precisely why they're here and the issues that bring them here. And that includes not just young people, but I met farmers who are here because they don't want to grow genetically modified foods, for instance. But the media is saying there are just a lot of people here along for a party who are not concerned really about the issues and don't even in fact know about the issues. I'm very surprised. I just can assume that some sections of the media just aren't talking to those people and finding out what their concerns are, and that's a shame because it's a huge effort to stand out here from 6 o'clock in the morning in the pouring rain. You don't do that unless you've got a good reason.
If the trade union movement called a meeting internationally, invited a few governments and a few business reps along and called it a World Economic Forum, could you imagine the scorn the media would pour on such a body?
The sorts of pictures and headlines that are being carried by the mainstream media, I think, are really just a reflection of what the World Economic Forum and our politicians would like us to take back from these protests. The Age leads with Battle of Melbourne, so I suppose once again the references to the Battle for Seattle, but certainly they're really whipping it up into a frenzy, and the it's just all focused on conflict between police and protesters. The Herald Sun, shameful.
Somebody who had been injured was approached by about half a dozen people from the mainstream media, and we asked the media to stand back while we ascertained the extent of her injuries and whether she was okay. And they simply told us that if she didn't answer questions straight away, then we'd lost the story. So it was a really disgraceful situation from the mainstream media. And I mean, I guess what can you expect? The people sitting inside the World Economic Forum own all those mainstream media outlets, and we've just got to be grateful that we've got a fantastic independent media network here to record what's really happening at the World Economic Forum.
Basically, indie media was set up about 6 weeks ago to sort of fill the void, the massive void left by the mainstream media with regards to coverage of S11. And we've got a website which 3CR has been uploading a lot of audio content to. People from Cigar have been uploading video. We've got text reports going up all the time, and been getting about 7,000 plus people looking at that site every day over the last few days, so that's been pretty exciting. And we've also put out 6,000 copies of an indie bulletin street paper each day with a bit of an update.
You know, everyone said we shouldn't have done this, but because the major parties and most of the media, with the exception of people like 3CR, don't listen to us, the young people have basically said, well, we've got no choice but to take to the streets. And that's how people are listening. And that's why you've got every media outlet here from BBC to 3CR down here listening to our agenda. And it's really justified the protest. It's been an absolutely magnificent 3 days.
There is so much hype. When I saw the news last night, it wasn't the event I was at. I walked the line at least 10 times yesterday from one end to the other, and I saw like thousands and thousands and thousands of people doing really spirited, really strong non-violent action, and it really had a good atmosphere to it. It was predictable what the Herald Sun and others were going to say, but don't believe the hype.
So I think the journalists in some sense are now on side, but what we're also hearing from them at the Sydney Alternative Media Centre is that the editors at the head offices of the major corporate press are actually changing the stories that are filed from their correspondents. And I think that this is really something that we might have to think about in the future, because what we're trying to build is an accurate method of reporting these incidents.
Well, you see, journalists are also unionised workers who work in big
factories that are owned by transnational corporations like, you know, News Limited and Fairfax and so forth. So it's very important that journalists understand that these protesters are peaceful, that they want to get the message across, that ultimately redundancies, sackings, individual contracts, those kinds of things can be perpetrated on journalists just as they can on any other workers. So there's control and there's ownership in the mainstream media that many journalists battle against to get their stories out, to have the truth heard. So what I'd say to those people who say protesting against this is futile, protesting against this is about the only thing that we have where we can make these people listen, because unless this kind of stuff happens, they will carry on ripping and pillaging the world's resources, you know, without hesitation, even if it meant their own destruction. That's how narrow some of the views of the people at the top end of our society are.
Hello, this is Malil Mamey from Bulagan, and you're listening to 3CR.
And fantastic past pieces from 2000, taking us back to S11 protests outside the World Economic Forum that was held in Melbourne, a pivotal event in the activist history of Melbourne. And 3CR, of course, was there reporting. We're going to go on to a piece that was given to me by the Homeless Persons Union. It's an interview with Murray, who's a person who lives at Five Ways Caravan Park, but not for very long because they've all been given eviction notices. And the Homeless Persons Union want to put forward that, in actual fact, the issue of homelessness is now a wildfire. And despite the building of many, many flats, this is not a replacement for public housing. They recently had an event at the CEO Sleepouts on Thursday in Melbourne, pressing the issue that St. Vinny's should probably be moving away from emergency care for housing with limited stays and moving on to creating a permanent housing stock for people who are in emergency needs. So let's hear what Murray has to say. He's speaking to Spike from the Homeless Persons Union.
Yes, it's a very, very stressful state that we're in at the moment. We've only got 8 weeks or so to go before we get thrown out, and we haven't got anywhere to go, some of us, and we don't have the money to go in to private rentals, and we just like to have a fair shake of the stick when it comes to being allocated housing. I mean, we've tried a lot of things. We just want somebody to open their doors. We feel helpless, completely helpless right at the moment. And I don't know what to do anymore. Yeah, my name's Murray, and I've been living at Five Ways Caravan Park in Dingley Village for 8 years. Last August, we were all served with eviction notices. We would not get any compensation for losing our homes. We'll lose $65,000 plus $10,000 to remove my dwelling. And there's probably still 30 people in the caravan park who are still looking for reasonable accommodation.
Yeah, so who's reached out to you so far? You said someone from Winteringham's been here.
Winteringham came out, and Access, part of Kingston Council, came out. They offered assistance. Winteringham have since lost their funding, so they can't help us anymore. A couple of months ago, The Age rang and asked whether they could do a story. So that was a good starting point. Then Raf Epstein from the ABC picked up on the story in The Age, and he rang me and I did an on-air interview with Raf via those two media things, A Current Affair decided to be in there or wanted to do a story. Other than that, most of the major Department of Housing won't do anything for us. A crowd called Launch, who are supposed to be the number one accommodation finding place, they just brush us off all the time. Every avenue that we try, we don't get any satisfaction at all.
Murray and the people that live here have paid taxes their whole working lives.
Exactly.
You would think the Department of Families, Fairness and Housing would have been out here to come and speak to you guys, at least say, look, I know what you're going through. I know it's tough. We're going to be doing our best to try and support you. Have you got anything from
No, yeah. No. We gain nothing from the Department of Housing, Fairness. They've never, ever, ever been offered to us. Who advocates for us? I mean, we've had to do all of the advocating off our own bat.
Yeah.
No one's come to us and said, okay, Johnny, we will circle the wagons and go out and advocate for what you require. No one. Access the council organisation. They've tried very hard, but they don't have the resources or they don't have the housing. They're not a housing organisation. They just liaise with the housing people, and that's where we're lost. No one's had our back. It's been a very, very solitary, and we haven't gained much apart from a little bit of media access. But as for finding places, Department of Housing told us that we can't do anything for you until you are actually homeless. Well, when we get shown the door, because we've been told that the police will come and escort us off the property, once we're out the front gate, where do we go? There's nowhere. I don't know what I will.
As time has gone on, the constant decrease in public housing has meant that we can't offer people who are in their 60s and 70s and 50s who are living in, who are still basically experiencing tertiary homelessness, which is a caravan park, that have no security of tenure. When there's a dearth of public housing, when there's a lack of public housing, who supports these people that are in crisis? The land upon which their dwellings are fixed is going to be sold out from underneath them, and they have no one. And it's really clear that they feel alone. They feel like they're not being heard, and the lack of public housing has left these people out in the lurch. You know, we're calling on the Department of Families of Fairness and Housing to go down there and support these guys and do what they can to make sure that they're not left to be escorted out by the police in 8 weeks. They've not committed any crime. They're not bad tenants. They've paid their rent. They've been actually really good tenants. There's no excuse for these people to be left out, to be left on the street, for anyone. There's no excuse for anyone to be on the street in a country as wealthy as Australia. Why hasn't the Department of Families, Fairness and Housing gone down there and been able to house these guys? When we know that there's thousands of empty public housing properties in Australia.
You're back with Annie, Tobiah, Matt and Amy on Solidarity Breakfast. And our last thing... Oh, we got you just at the wrong time, David.
Sorry, I didn't realise. I was live on
there. No, we just switched the switch and you were... David Glantz, he's from Refugee Action Collective, RAAC, and today is International Refugee Day.
Yes, thanks for having me on. The work is miserable, but the policies for refugees coming from the current government are even worse. We're out today, refugees and refugee supporters, at the State Library from 2 o'clock, when the rain should be a little bit less heavy, I'm pleased to say, calling for justice for refugees and for refugee rights. We've got a government that has brought in wave after wave of legislation, essentially to make life more difficult for many refugees and asylum seekers. Pauline Hanson talks about deporting refugees. Labour is actually doing that right now with legislation that allows them to grab people off the streets and send them to the South Pacific island of Nauru. So that's one of the many horrors we'll be calling out today.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because Pauline Hanson's just dog whistling. Like you say, the Labor tries to outdo One Nation when it comes to refugees. Also, Pauline Hanson has basically put out untruths about refugees being allowed to work, refugees having access to social welfare systems within Australia. These are just actually not true.
Well, it depends on individuals' visas. Actually, there are some refugees in this country on bridging visas who do have the right to work, access Medicare and education, or to get a very small welfare payment, less than JobSeeker. The rules are very arbitrary. There are people on exactly the same visa who are not allowed to work. There are people who lose their Medicare access because their visa has to come up for renewal every 6 months. And sometimes it seems like somebody in the department is just playing games, making people's life misery. So the real crime is not that people are getting this, it's that they're not, people who are recognised as refugees are not getting permanent residency and allowed to build their lives. Now, the struggle of refugees themselves over the last 2 years has actually won a victory against the Labor government. I think it's important to recognise that. People might remember, not last year, I think it was the year before, that refugees took to the streets. They set up encampments outside MPs' offices and the Department of Border Force down in Docklands.
Yep.
And that campaign, at the time, Labor gave no ground, but very quietly, a few months later, they didn't actually allow those refugees who were being rejected on something called Fast Track, but who were living in the country. They give them the right to apply for permanent residency. And we know that many of those people now do have permanent residency. But that's not an act of government kindness. That's as a result of struggle by refugees, supported by people like the Refugee Action Collective.
It's really this business about dividing the community into refugees and non-refugees. I mean, it's an appalling thing for people who have... nobody leaves their home unless something is really wrong. It's a terrible, terrible thing to become fleeing from your country. And the idea that we should attack people rather than welcome them is a crime in itself, really.
Yeah, overwhelmingly, refugees coming to this country are coming from war zones or authoritarian governments. And very often those war zones are war zones where Australian troops have been on the ground contributing. So you look at it, it's Iran, Iraq, Sudan, Myanmar. People don't come here and claim refugee status from France or Japan because their lives are, you know, more or less okay. I mean, there's room for improvement, but they're not being persecuted. People come here because of persecution and fear that their lives are at risk. They could be killed or at least tortured. And those are people who get on boats or get on planes and make the decision to leave their homeland, which would be a very wrenching one, but one that people take when they're absolutely desperate. So the trauma that the Australian government imposes on these people is re-traumatising people who have already suffered. And there are refugees in this country who've been here 13 years waiting for a permanent visa, their life on hold, their children growing up with no certainty, families that could be pulled to pieces, and that's on top of the trauma that led them to leave their homes in the first place. And the numbers involved are really tiny. In the case of Papua New Guinea, we're down to maybe a couple of dozen refugees who have been left marooned in Port Moresby by Australian government policy. You could fit them on the back of a tram, you know, with a Mikey, and bring them to this country. The numbers are tiny, and the government cruelty is enormous.
So you're calling on people to come to the rally today at 2 p.m. outside the State Library to push for a better deal for refugees and to make sure that Australia realises that refugees are people and that we should be welcoming them.
Absolutely. Bring your umbrella, but rain or shine, we'll be there standing up for refugee rights.
And before you go, David, one of our reminders is that there was going to be the last of the anti-Zionist Australian talks. Kim Billimore was going to be talking about the exploring Labor Zionism and its role in the colonisation of Palestine during the British Mandate. Apparently you were told that there was no room at Catherine Syme's library.
We were told very late last night, when I say late last night, after close of business, that due to something called community safety, that the Anti-Zionism Australia forum at Catherine Syme tomorrow afternoon couldn't go ahead. It's actually a forum on Christian Zionism delivered by Veronica. And,
oh, sorry.
No, that's okay. The point is the same. We've had a series of these seminars. They've been well attended. They've been interesting and respectful discussions. And out of nowhere, someone, I don't know who this someone is, but someone has contacted the libraries and said, oh, panic. This will cause a lack of community safety. This is absolute nonsense. What is clearly happening is supporters of Israeli genocide are taking any opportunity to try and quell dissent.
We've got hardly any time, so where is it going to be relocated?
Look at our Instagram account, Anti-Zionism Australia, because we're still working on that. We will certainly go ahead, and if you check out our Instagram account, we will make sure that everybody knows where and when.
Thanks very much, David.
No worries.
Bye-bye. And that is a wrap, because we have got no time for anything.
Perfect. We'll see you guys next week and see you on the streets. Ballinballin Place at 3 p.m. to see Rowan Cahill, 2 p.m. at State Library.
You could go to the Green Left 3CR fundraiser tonight at 6 p.m. at the MUA rooms.
And
in
Amy,
Island
what's
Street
on Thursday?
Oh, yeah, we've got, if you live out west and you don't like the idea of an AI data centre, head to Sydenham Neighbourhood House on Thursday, 25th of June, 6:30 p.m. and have your say.
Thank you, and stay anti-fascist. We'll see you next week. Asia Pacific Currents up next. Fabrizio Ceruso, Walter Rossi, figli della stessa madre, figli della stessa rabbia. Fumo nero, copertone brucia. Fumo nero, copri le città. Lo stesso fumo nel tempo.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.